Welcome to Directionally Correct, a Felix podcast with Cole and Scott. Today's guest, nobody.
There you go.
There we go.
I love it. Thanks to our sponsors, Lightcast. The world is full of talent data, but more data can lead to more questions, uncertainty, and stagnation as organizations sift through it to figure out what's fact from what's fiction. Lightcast's talent intelligence platform answers your most difficult workforce questions to drive meaningful business results. With more than 20 years of experience as MCM Burning Glass, Lightcast accelerates your work, bringing together hundreds of billions of vetted, constantly updated data points and incredible insights to drive strategic talent decisions. Your organization can tap into the deepest open repository of skills, supply, and demand data in the world to transform your hunches into a skills-based future for your organization. Lightcast's flexible solution, used by 67 of the Fortune 100, can integrate your own data, be guided by in-house talent experts, and give you the tools and confidence to explore it for yourself. To learn more, book a demo at lightcast.io. All opinions are our own and do not reflect those of any other organization.
I don't know what a vertical monitor is.
Oh, come on.
I'm serious. I have no idea what a do you literally mean it's like a monitor that faces upwards?
Yeah, so you got a landscape orientation to 99% of monitors, right? You know, just like where it's wider than it is tall.
Oh, you mean like vertically oriented?
Yeah.
I thought you meant like it faces towards the sky.
Well, that's just insane.
Yeah, I know. That's why I was like, this sounds ridiculous.
It'd be like a... I don't know, like a museum exhibit or something like that, right? However, yeah. I'm kind of down with that too. I mean, that's what people do with their laptops, right? You just like have the laptop point up at your face.
Well, I've seen this trend of like people that work at tech companies, they will lay on their back and then have their monitors above them, but that's facing downward. You were talking about facing upward, which means you're hanging in the air above your screen so that you can work.
I think that may be like over engineering the scenario, right? I think it just means looking down at the monitors, but I'm just talking about having it vertically oriented so you can read an entire PDF, an entire web page at one time, right?
And so you that's your preferred method?
It would be. I don't know. I don't have this technology. That's my problem. I'm looking for it. That's why I'm stealing a monitor from you.
Well, I've never seen anyone use a vertical monitor that way.
That's what I'm saying. It just doesn't exist. Like, not in any sort of sufficient capacity, right?
You know how they say, like, it took them, like, 50 years to invent wheels on suitcases? Or maybe longer than that?
That is insane. Seeing people, like, carrying a suitcase around.
Yeah. But I feel like this is, like, one of those things. Like, what if we find out we should have been doing vertical monitors the whole time, and we're just dumb for doing it landscape?
Well, I mean, like vertical videos are back. Like everyone films themselves, or you know, you get the phone and you put it vertically. Where you used to get chastised, right? And remember this? I don't know if you remember the whole movement. Like, oh, people got upset if you recorded video vertically.
I do not remember this movement.
Oh man, it's like
pre-TikTok.
Right. But I mean, vertical videos are back, baby. That's what I'm talking about.
You know what else is back?
What's up?
Yacht Rock. Do you listen to Yacht Rock?
I think I just suggested that we listen to some Yacht Rock, and I may have had some buyer's remorse, actually.
You have buyer's remorse for listening to Yacht Rock? Yacht Rock is fantastic.
It is not offensive. It is easy to work to. It's easy to have a conversation with someone in the room.
So here's my question about Yacht Rock. Where did the high-pitched male voice from Yacht Rock go, right? You never hear, like, there were many of these artists, like Michael McDonald's, like one of them, where they're like, how's it going to go and is it going to be? Yeah. You know, like, where did that go? Because that was fantastic, and I love it. Or, I haven't heard it in 30 years in a new song.
And the falsetto, that's a thing, right? Like, think about like some of those like old like Frankie Valli songs. It's the predates Yacht Rock, where it's like you just got these wild, like out of the blue, just super high pitched.
Yeah, well, or like Journey or any of those bands. Like, where did the high pitched male, you know, singing voice, go.
Journey. Did Journey have high pitch?
Yeah, that guy had high pitch.
Apparently, like, he died, I think, or was fired. I can't remember which.
I think he was fired.
But they found some dude that sounded just like him. He just happened to be Asian, which is really weird in itself.
I have heard but this.
It sounds exactly like him.
Which is fantastic. But again, the Asian guy couldn't create his own band today because that doesn't exist anymore. Right? I don't know. I just want to know, where did it go and why can't we bring it back?
You want more Yacht Rock in your life.
I want more of the male falsetto or whatever.
You are a country club Cole, so I mean.
Whatever, dude.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm still fixated on the monitors, right? Like, see, you got me like thinking about all the possibilities, not to bring it back. But like, what if you took your monitors and just like mounted them on the ceiling and just laid on the floor and just worked?
Well, that's what I was talking about. They actually make these chairs now where people, you sit in it like a dentist chair, and then they lay the chair back and the monitor comes with you as you lay back. I promise these things exist.
Oh, so it's like a space chair. It's all one unit and it's fixed.
Correct.
Okay.
And so as the chair leans back, the monitor comes with the chair, and then you just, you know, I think it's mostly programmers that use it. So you just program while you're laying on your back.
That's just intense wackiness. Like, just give me the Apple goggles or whatever they are.
But I don't even like the dentist's office. You know, like, why would I want a chair that feels like I'm going to the dentist?
Does your dentist allow you to watch TV on the ceiling? That's next level.
I would argue they do the opposite, which is they force me to watch things I don't want to watch. You know,
they give you a little like Young and the Restless or something like that.
Well, I have seen that before, but it's more like these like shows. Like the last time I went, you know, these shows that were like people. I don't know what you describe. We used to have like Nickelodeon as a kid, and they'd have like people would get slimed on Nickelodeon.
Yeah.
It's like the adult version of those shows. I don't even know what you would call them, where it's like people are trying to go through an obstacle course, but then they're going to fall in the lava, you know, like that kind of stuff.
Oh, with the big red balls. Oh my God, what's that called?
I don't know.
Apparently they film all those in Argentina.
Well, that makes a lot of sense.
There's an entire channel devoted to it. On my TV. I don't know how I got so lucky, but you can watch that 24/7.
Fantastic. And you can go to my dentist's office too.
How do you think you would do? How do you think you would do on one of those shows? Could you make it? So there's two kinds. There's like the one you're talking about where I wish I remember the name of it, but like where they run through the obstacle course and it's got like mud and like you bounce off big red balls, you know, this sort of thing. And then you got the like Ninja Warrior where it's like you got to do all sorts of crazy shit like the warp wall.
So for sure can't do Ninja Warrior. I'm not capable.
Like a no-go.
And I'm just going to be straight with you. You're not capable either. So we're in the same boat. The other obstacle course things, it seems like the people are just really unstrategic in terms of how they go about doing it a lot of times. Like, I think that some, like, depending on the level of difficulty, yeah, I could probably do it because they make a bunch of dumb decisions.
I love that you're critiquing their strategy for this ostensibly a linear course.
Well, like, we're getting way too much into the specifics here. Like, I was at the dentist's office, and this lady's like, what if I dip my leg into lava? And then that'll make it my shoes more traction-y when I go down the rest of the course. I'm like, no, it's going to make it more slippery. What are you doing? Like, it's like dumb, like basic foot fault stuff that they're doing. Like,
I don't know. I think she has a point.
All right. Well, agree to disagree.
No, I tell you, like, I took a – this is the weirdest thing ever, but at my parents' place, they just have, like, live in the country. And whenever they have old food, they don't want to put it in the trash or, like, in the disposal or anything like that. You just, like, throw it out back, like, quite literally. Like, they have a fence out back, and you throw it over the fence and let the vultures eat it. Seriously, dead serious. So I was at the back porch and I had these potatoes, like these old potatoes that had grown eyes, and I launched those motherfuckers over the fence, but I thought I threw my arm out too. I was like, oh my God, it's been so long since I've thrown something like that. It's like a little bit heavier than a baseball. So I mean, you can get some like good heft on it, But I was like, oh man, you really need to warm up. Really got to warm up.
Yeah. Well, not to mention, this is also proving my hypothesis about not finishing the American Ninja Warrior course.
Yeah, that's where I was going. Like, I like to think that like I could run up the warped wall. It's like, you know, only like 16 feet tall.
These very, very fit and in shape, you know, 20-year-olds aren't making it up. I'm not making it up.
Well, I mean, they just have bad strategy, right?
No, I was talking about the lava people. Now, could you do the lava course?
I don't think that there's any like real winners or losers in that course. I could make it. I don't know if I'd place, right? But
I mean, what you're doing is you're already like doing better than like 75% of the people because they're not making it.
just for clarity, you're talking about the wall that like punches you. It's got like a punching glove that comes out the side and
I'll be honest, into the mud. I think we may be talking about different shows, but I don't think it matters at this point. Like, they're all the same.
It really does feel like a dystopian, like Running Man future. You know, it's like where it's just people's pain and embarrassment for our entertainment.
That's really what it is. You can't help but watch it and be like, I'm better than these people. You know, like, I think it's just like these little things to boost our self-esteem. That's really why they exist.
Especially when like you find out they're fighting over like a cash prize of like $4,500 or something like that. You're like, wow, this is a lot to go through for. You're going to have to divide that 50% for taxes. And like, you're not talking about walking away with a whole lot, really.
Yeah. I mean, I think people just want to be famous, you know?
Oh, yeah.
That's really what it comes down to. You're getting paid in fame, not in dollars. Well, we got SOP coming up.
Yes. Speaking of obstacle courses. Yeah, how you feeling, man? You feeling? You ready? Geared up?
Yeah, man. I think we've kind of pimped it on a few podcasts, but since it's getting pretty close now, it's getting to be real, you know?
Yeah.
How are you feeling? Like, what is your PSYOP preparation kit? Like, how do you prepare to go?
Well, I mean, we're reaching that pre-PSYOP time. So you got to like lay off the pizza, lay off the pasta. You got to get svelte, you know?
Got to get tight.
Lay off the booze, you know, only on the weekends sort of thing. You got to look good. You got to look good for all those people that, you know, you only see like once a year and you only see them in passing, even at that. No, I'm really excited. It's the best time of the year. Love PSYOP time. You get to go see all your peeps, especially if you've been to a couple different companies and you get to see these people that you don't get to see, you know, but once a year, really. And of course, just great knowledge sharing that goes along with PSYOP and to see what all the grad students are coming up with and new advances and like what really gets the field energized. It's a great time of year. A lot of anticipation coming up.
It's the most wonderful time of the year.
We need a PSYOP advent calendar. So like got the 25 days of PSYOP or something like that, you know?
You say that. I bet you somebody will create that.
I bet they will, and they should. And they should make me number one or something like that.
Make you number, you're already number one.
Cole's number one. Make Cole number one.
Speaking of, like, do you think, I always like to stir the pot a little bit, you know this. Do you think PSYOP is the number one people analytics conference?
Is it? I think you're better qualified to answer this than I am. I don't really feel I have a good grasp on what differentiates IO from people analytics in to begin with. It's,
well, I'll say,
to my knowledge, it's the biggest.
Even if let's put it this way, there's a qualitative difference between kind of these like for-profit conferences that are put on either by firms themselves or kind of conference running companies.
So that's what you're talking about.
And then like, you know, conferences that are not for profit that are primarily started by academics, right? There's a qualitative difference in how those look, but like, does PSYOP, you know, is it qualitatively different or better in some ways?
I mean, like, once again, I don't attend a lot of these for-profit conferences or, you know, ones put on by smaller companies. I will say that there are, it's the meeting place between academics and practitioners that we don't really get in other places. So yes, I have been invited to say quote unquote professional conferences mm-hmm. where it's I don't know, a bunch of people that are, you know, head of people analytics, or maybe some your odd CHRO in there, or, you know, your odd researcher or whatnot in there. But they tend to have a commercial slant, like they're trying to kind of pimp their own company in certain ways, where I don't really see PSYOP as doing that. Even if, you know, on the slides at symposiums, people put their company, it doesn't feel as commercial.
Yeah, commercial interest isn't the point. It may exist, but it's not the purpose.
No. Well, I mean, like, what's your opinion? Like, you've held roles where you've attended. Hell, you've
a lot
started. Yeah. You hosted a ton of these things.
Yeah, I would say it's kind of, PSYOP's like a weird conundrum, where percentage wise of the content that is on the program that I would say is like people analytics practitioner heavy,
yeah,
is actually percentage wise is not that great. Like maybe it's like 20-30% of the sessions at PSYOP are related to that. But I would also say at the same time, because there's so many sessions at PSYOP, that ends up blowing any other conference out of the water in terms of the high quality content that there is for that type of work. And I would say the sheer number of people that are people analytics practitioners also blows any other conference out of the water. And so I think it's number one, and it's number one by a good margin. My only concern or caveat to that is I think that there's folks that are not IO psychologists that don't necessarily feel included, but that's one of the things that I'm actively working on trying to change, so that PSYOP really does kind of become the number one people analytics conference, hands down, no debate.
So, I mean, like you covered a lot of ground right there that we could unpack. So, one, there's a ton of sessions, but are you saying that there's a ton of sessions that just are not applicable to practitioners in general?
Well, they're just like academic sessions. Somebody might do like, you know, maybe we can get into this a second. It was kind of like along the lines of the question I wanted to ask you originally, which is like, how do you prepare?
Oh,
like,
okay.
How do you figure out what sessions to go to? Like, what's your methodology? Because I think my methodology will answer that question that you just asked me.
Well, go ahead. How do you decide?
I literally, it's very unscientific. I go through and I look for topics that I'm interested in. I literally search the terms like people analytics or analytics or machine learning or natural language processing or text analytics, or, you know, all the buzzwords, essentially, like organizational network analysis. And I find all the sessions that have those type of things in the title, and I just put them all into like the little app, or I still like having the paper copy. They don't really have those.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I try to get my hands on one if I can, but I'll put them all in the app, and that'll be my PSYOP programming, because that's what I kind of mean by this. There's so much other stuff that's going on at PSYOP. People don't realize like how much other stuff there is other than those topics. And so, I mean, and not to mention like the poster sessions, and the like the Wednesday sessions, and the what are those even called? Like the alternate sessions.
I don't know what those are called.
Like the pre-conference workshops.
Like the workshops.
The pre-conference workshops. They even have during the conference workshops now too. So like there's so much stuff to go to. I just try to find the things that are gonna like, you know, pique my interest. And also like literally I'll search for people's names who I know who usually present, who I like their stuff, and I'll just find those too.
Yeah, you take a much more thorough approach than I do. One, I get my little PSYOP catalog, my little brochure that you pick up at the entry hall. And within about 17 minutes, that's rolled up into a baton sort of orientation, right? Now I got a little baton that I'll carry around for at least that day. Maybe even 2 days. I don't know. But one, I talk to people beforehand, and I see what sessions they're going to be attending or they're going to be talking at. That's going to be like tier one. Tier two is I'm going to be talking to people in the poster room most likely, or like the what do they call it? Where all the vendor room. I don't know what do you call it.
The big room.
The big room. The big room. And invariably, there'll be a session that I wanted to attend to, but like I've already waited too long to actually go, so we don't go to that one. And then there's like a break.
These are the real problems. Like this is it in a nutshell.
This is the way it rolls. And then it's like, hey, I'm like with my friend, you know, friend whoever, and I say, do you want to go to a session? And we'll look in the catalog and be like, yeah, let's go peep on this one, and you know, maybe go in. And that's pretty much how it happens. And it's all about the connections, really. I love the research, but I get a lot out of the posters, especially since they put in a lot of effort. Posters, a lot of effort.
Yeah, it is the worst combination of effort versus reward in the SIOP conference, with a close second of symposiums. But yeah, it's yeah. Anyway, enough said about that. Well, and what people don't realize, like, there's like this, you know, let's call it like underbelly to SIOP, where it's like, what's the real conference? The real conference is like the alumni parties and the vendor parties and, you know, like all the other stuff, like the hallway conversations, the catching up with old friends. Like that's the real part. I mean, you have to have a really good session. I probably shouldn't say this publicly, but you have to have a really good session if I'm going to stay all the way through. I probably make it all the way through two sessions every SIOP. I'll attend 20.
Yeah, I'm with you.
All the way through two of them.
Cruise the hallways to kind of like see what's going on, see if anything like catches your eye. An hour and a half session to be stuck in a room for an hour and a half that's a long time.
It's really tough to get me to stick around. Yeah, like you got to be bringing your A game, and it's got to be like really good for me to stick around.
Well, I mean, this is what would economists call it? The cost of choice, or you know, like there's a cost associated with your choices that you make. So like because you go to one session, you can't attend another.
Granted, yeah, like
opportunity cost. Thank you very much. SIOP does a good job of posting recordings, and we look forward to that. And hopefully our session will get recorded and we can like pull that for later. But you only have so much time, and like obviously they can't spread SIOP over a month period, so you can catch it all.
Yeah. Well, I'll say this. If you attend nothing else, attend the live recording of Directionally Corrected SIOP. I know we've touched on it a couple of times, but it's worth saying one more time.
You can have high quality content like you're getting right now, right?
And you can have it in person. And you can see like how unimpressive Scott and I are as human beings.
I will show everyone my rolled up SIOP baton. Definitely.
Well, and we got some great guests. Like all of them are returning guests. And these are some of our, you know, more popular episodes. You got Anthony Ferreras. You've got Amy Stevenson. You got Rob Stilson, Emily Pelosi, Kelsey Colley. I don't think I'm missing. I think that's everybody.
God damn, they're all smarter than me.
They are. They're all smarter than both of us. But that's okay. That's why we do a podcast.
That's why I do it. It should be a lot of fun. Like you and I have already talked about the format. Like, so we're probably going to have one or two questions just because like there's so many people on the panel, and it's 50 minutes.
Yeah.
50 minutes, something like that.
I don't know. It's the best 50 minutes of whoever attends life. That's what
it is. Yes. Yes. So like we'll do just like kind of like a condensed version. So we'll do some questions. We'll do some confusion matrix. We'll do some nerdery and get out of there. Hopefully everyone will be wildly entertained.
It will be great. I'm curious. One of the topics I think is going to come up a lot at SIOP this year is, you know, AI, generative AI, totally. Yada, yada, yada. It's going to be, you know, probably throughout every kind of session. But I'm curious, this is something I've been thinking about lately. What do you, like, in terms of, like, how IOs or people analytics practitioners are educated in the future? What, like, let's say we fast forward to 2030. How is someone becoming an IO psychologist? Is it still the exact same way as we went through grad school together, or is it something different?
Oh man, this is the big question, right? It's the name of our game is prediction, right? So like, especially prediction of like how the workforce will be planned in the future. So why not turn the mirror on ourselves and just kind of like pontificate on what to expect for our world? I would say, one, I would be both excited and scared for what the future holds as an IO. Because a lot of the like technical skills, IO is a range. It's going to pick your own adventure. If you want to go highly technical, you want to learn ML, you want to learn NLP, go have at it. That's totally fine. If you want to go be a consultant, if you want to learn OD, and like you're not really interested in, say, like hardcore research, go have at it. Have fun, this sort of thing. So it's always been a kind of a wide range here. But some of those skills are going to go away with the advent of Gen AI. So if you're talking about the hardcore skills that every IO should know, I would say, one, get super deep on theory. Get really familiar with developing mental models about everything from performance to onboarding employees to compensation, like how you reward employees, how you try to retain them. I would try to read as much as possible. So like ironically, and I'm not talking about have ChatGPT read it for you and summarize shit for you. I'm talking about read it, really understand the material really, really well so that you can form your own opinions, diverse opinions, see the counterbalances that are needed for different arguments, this sort of stuff. And from like a research perspective, like, yeah, you can get Gen AI to, you know, write code for you and interpret shit for you. Really understand what's going on under the hood. Understand what, say, what's going on in a ANOVA, what's going on in a regression. So when you see a R square value, you can really speak to what it's doing and not just, oh, the machine popped it out. So, I mean, like, ironically, as much as Gen AI will take over sort of like the mundane stuff, you need to be really familiar with this sort of stuff. You need to be familiar with like the theoretical stuff. Because once again, we're trying to understand human nature at the end of the day. And if you have this framework and ideas around that, it's going to make you more valuable.
You know,
sorry, I went on a big
diatribe right there. I think there was a lot of wisdom in there. I really do. I'm not just saying that to fluff you up, Scott.
Flattery will get you everywhere though. So please do.
Yeah. Well, I'll kind of go orthogonal to what you're saying, because I think I agree with pretty much all of it. The apprentice-based model, I don't hear anybody else really describing PhD programs this way, but it's really an apprentice-based model versus like a lecture-style education model that most education is
yes.
in your life. And what you find in an apprentice-based model is you're able to learn things differently, much like a master craftsman would learn them, right? And you get to go deep on different topics. I think about like the LLMs as they're currently constituted. So I'm not going to try to predict the future, right? But just as they currently exist today, are really good at summarizing the state of the knowledge as it exists
yes.
on the internet, right? You know what they're not good at as stating the knowledge of? Things that aren't on the internet. and I think that's actually where the beauty of a PhD program is going to come in, is because much of the stuff that you learn is through experience and through, again, the apprentice model of, you know, taking the apprentice being trained by the master trainer, right?
Yeah.
And that's kind of an interesting and unique model. And so in some ways, I think that won't change for a lot of the technical subjects that exist in our discipline. What I do think will change dramatically is research summarization and knowledge gathering of like I think like one of the things I spent a lot of time on was reading papers and finding citations and doing lit reviews.
Yeah.
I think I spent a lot of time doing that. I think at least with the technology that exists today, although imperfect, as it gets more and more integrated over the next few years, will be the knowledge summarization machines. And that I think will change substantially.
So
in terms of the number of hours you spend doing it.
Yeah, I mean, but to what end? So you're saying just like, I have a research idea and I need, ChatGPT to churn me out a intro section? Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying, like, let's say you're even starting with a blank slate of, I have an idea. I want to research job analysis.
Yeah.
ChatGPT, can you give me the state of job analysis broken down by decade of the different evolutions that job analysis has made over the last 60 years? Tell me the key findings and give me the relevant, most top-cited research articles, right?
It
could have been a month undertaking while I was in a PhD program and could be done in, you know, minutes now.
Yes. Yes. And I think those sort of things are going to speed us up. I thought you were taking a different stance, which I disagree with.
I wasn't taking it.
Don't let me disagree with you unless I have to. That's talk about the skills of the future. Yes. Being able to perform a lit review. And I got a separate point here I'd like to make if I can remember it, but being able to develop a cogent argument is going to be critical, right?
Yeah.
So being familiar with the literature, being able to describe your ideas in a way that, because like to your point, ChatGPT can do a lot of things, but if you don't know why you're pursuing this research, then why are you fucking pursuing the research?
Well, I let me violently agree with you. I think I wrote this in an article a while back. I can't remember exactly how I said it, but like think of it like control variables in like a multiple regression. When you control for everything, the only things that left, you know, if everything goes down to zero, the only thing that's left goes to 100, right? So if you control for all of like knowledge or combing the research, yeah, all that's left is critical thinking. And therefore, critical thinking becomes the most important variable.
As a side, kind of like to the point you were making earlier, we had Jen Diamond Acosta on some weeks ago, and we had this nerdery article around citation counts and do researchers take them seriously if there's a low citation count. This is where like ChatGPT could come in like really handy, or some sort of like whatever the next iteration is, finding those articles that you wouldn't necessarily click on or more difficult to find that could make a better argument for you or provide additional insights that you wouldn't necessarily see or otherwise use, right? It's going to be a wildly better able to find research that you can build off of.
I totally agree. That's what, like, the cost of knowledge is going to go down to zero.
It should. It should. Hell, we had another nerdery article some time ago essentially showed that the journal prices, that decreased the citation counts. So the more access you have to information. Oh, man, I'm about to go on a different sort of rant. I don't really want to go there, so I won't go there.
If you don't want to go there, let's not go there.
Don't make me do it, Cole. Don't make me do it.
Do it.
I don't know what it is. It's getting weird now.
All right.
Well, I don't want to bring up the issues with Gen AI. What I do want to bring up is this zombie deer disease. You heard this?
No. What is it?
So we got this article from the Daily Mail that says, scientists fear zombie deer disease could spread to humans after first ever case of fatal brain virus that makes animals drool and unafraid of humans was detected in Yellowstone National Park.
Detected in a deer or a human?
I don't know. It's just a headline.
That's a really, really important distinction.
I wish I could show you this.
Realize this is how every zombie movie starts, right?
Well, I mean, this is exactly how I felt in, I don't know, January of 2020, when you start hearing these stories of like this mysterious virus from China, you know, and you're like, oh, wow, this is like crazy stuff. Or like you look at a zombie movie, it's like in the background, the very beginning, it's like, well, it's a news report of this like weird stuff going on in this Uzbekistan. And you're like, oh, that'll never affect me.
No. I just don't think that it's plausible things could go down like a zombie movie actually goes down. Because if human beings started like biting and killing other human beings, the news would have a field day. They would love it. Because, you know, And so there would be no underplaying what's going on. There would be like, they're murdering everyone.
Well, I mean, do you fear your dear overlord? I think that's the real question.
Well, I think we need some more specifics on this before I fear my dear overlords. Like, what is going on in Yellowstone?
I don't know. Here, let's see if I can find any additional details. Unfortunately, it's like a clip on Twitter, not like a link to an article. This person says, deer aren't afraid of humans in places that you can't hunt them, which is probably a valid point. But
I feel like that's already the case before zombies existed.
I mean, it sounds like our old friend toxoplasmosis, right? Very similar sort of behavior.
See, but I thought toxoplasmosis made you more crazy, not less.
Oh, no, this makes them crazy. Like, they're not afraid of humans, and they drool, which I guess is abnormal behavior.
Yeah, well, it doesn't sound like it's, I mean, it's bad for people who are driving late at night and deer are in the road, but it doesn't sound like it's actually like, are they attacking people? Are they attacking each other?
For the purposes of this, I'll say yes. I will spread disinformation if it makes for a better pod. Definitely.
Okay, well, I am now sufficiently fearful of the disinformation you're spreading.
Do you have deer out here?
Yeah, well, mostly rabbits. There's lots of rabbits.
It's a big difference. Like a rabbit yeah. is different than like I guess a rabbit deer.
And for the listeners, this is the first time Scott and I have recorded in person in a while. So
I don't know how well it's going, but we're doing it.
We are doing it. It is happening. How well it's happening is up for debate.
Oh, so I can't believe you're not more afraid of the zombie deer. I mean, it's a sign of it's the first sign of the apocalypse.
Is it the first sign of the apocalypse?
Honestly, it's probably just going to go way of like all the other sort of like crazy things, like the killer bees and the murder hornets. Remember that from 2020?
I am so much more scared of bees like ceasing to exist than I am of murder hornets.
Wait, so you're worried about bees being going extinct?
Yeah, like I mean, hasn't there been this huge trend of like bees are like basically their numbers are just like decreasing exponentially, and I mean it like the true use of that word exponentially, and like that's way more scary than murder hornets.
There's someone near my parents' place that'll take like bees and put them on a truck and like let them pollinate other farmers' fields. Yeah, really cool. Really cool thing. Yeah.
You know, they used to not have to do that because the bees were just there. That's the point.
Fucking zombie deer. Just zombie ruining bees. Everything.
Well, this was fun discussion.
I don't think you're engaging in the zombie deer the way I was really hoping you would.
I'd like it to have a little bit more information to engage.
I think that's a fair point as well. Let's do some quick nerdery.
The nerdery.
I'm trying to think like what would be most jazzy.
Jazzy? Oh shit.
Maybe this one. Moving from insights to impact. So you know me from doing these nerdery articles. One of the things I like to do.
I've known you from these nerdery articles.
Well, I there's a theme to the ones that I end up choosing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's when some academics do some highly applied work. I love to give it some love. Right? Yeah. And so we've got some academics, so Thomas Rasmussen, Mike Ulrich, and Dave Ulrich, all of which are very well-known academics in the people analytics space, wrote an article in the Human Resource Development Review called Moving People Analytics from Insight to Impact. And what they're talking about is, you know, we not getting lost on the wrong things. So they specifically call out like doing benchmarking, reporting, following best practices, or being enamored by just things that are like hot topics like predictive analytics, and focusing on the things that will actually make an impact in the business. Now, this is a paywalled article, so they don't actually go through the things that you can find, but I did want to call this out of, you know, one of the things that I see going on in the people analytics space is we came from an era of where we were just showered with resources, right? And what's happened is we're moving into an area where companies are becoming a little bit more resource constrained.
Mm-hmm.
When you're in a resource constrained environment, you've got to get just beyond doing things because they're insightful. You've got to move to things that have an impact on the business to kind of justify your existence. And so I just wanted to call this article out in that vein, that I think it's very timely and I wanted to give the authors credit for doing such applied work.
Well, kudos to them. Follow the business needs, right? We're not just here trying to discover, new things and just have cool, shiny insights. You got to actually apply it to be useful.
Absolutely.
And that the Amabile definition of creativity has got to be novel and useful.
I didn't know that. And I've actually followed some of her research. I didn't know that. That's very simple. I like that.
No. Is there any more we can dig in there? It's very apt. It's very timely. Especially now when we've gone through a period of layoffs in a variety of companies, resources are more constrained.
Can I tell you, it was a complete side tangent about Teresa Amabile.
I would love it.
I remember my first job at a graduate school. I had this big idea for a model that we were going to put together to try to get a research grant to run off of. And it was based somewhat on her work and a few other people's work. And I was like, this is new. This is cutting edge. This is nobody's ever thought of this. And my boss at the time just shot he didn't even respond with words. He just shot me an article. And it was the same research that had already been done. It was oh, I'm so dumb. God, I had spent so much time on it too. And I was so proud of it. And it I still remember the feeling of that taking the wind out of my sails. This was no response. It was just, yes, already been done. Good luck.
I'm going to do some research and figure out if there's a correlation between job satisfaction and performance.
Yeah.
Let's do this.
Got a new one. Maybe if we paid people, they would work harder.
Yeah, right.
Oh, my God.
Well, here's our next article. It's have you heard of these zombie deer attacks?
No.
It's a research policy, May 2022, crowdsourcing research questions in science. So crowd involvement in research tends to be limited to empirical activities. We study the nature and quality of research questions generated by crowd members. Average crowd RQs, research questions, have lower novelty, scientific impact, but similar practical impact as professional research questions. So crowd research questions outperform on all dimensions after selection within and across individuals. We interpret this result in light of five crowd paradigms distilled from prior literature. So apparently these researchers are questioning whether we should crowdsource our research questions for actual insights. And they have some advantages, but overall lower novelty with similar scientific impact.
Interesting. I just wonder, would you get
practical impact? Pardon me.
Well, practical impact. I think about this just on generating new theory, right?
Yeah.
So if you tried to crowdsource and generate new theory, would you get more better new theories or more less good theory? I think that's interesting. I think you would get the intuitive theories, you would probably get more good ones, but for counterintuitive theories, you would get more bad ones or less good ones.
So I think the practical impact is interesting. So you got an incentive structure to come up with new and novel things in organizations. Let's say you're talking about developing research that doesn't have as much practical impact, but that's how people get promoted, right? Coming up with new, interesting, cool things. The same with researchers. We're coming up with new novel sort of models on human behavior or, whatever the hell they're trying to do, but does it have an actual impact?
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess it depends.
I think what my reaction to this just more generally is crowdsourcing things a few years ago was very hot. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's some things that it's really good at, like prediction markets. Crowdsourcing things in a prediction market is super helpful, right? To understand what are some likely outcomes for the future. Crowdsourcing new ideas, I feel like is a way of getting to mediocrity sometimes, right? Because you're just taking the average of everybody's ideas sort of. So I don't know. I maybe I'm not being charitable enough, but I think it can definitely help in some ways, and in other ways, it probably has limitations.
I'm guessing that the average crowdsource idea comes from a person that has only superficially thought about the topic. Therefore, you come up with less deep sort of insights, right? It's less nuanced. Whereas someone that is like really deep in a topic would come up with a more nuanced opinion. But with that said, just because you're deep doesn't mean it's good.
Now, I think this is still called like considered crowdsourcing, but I bet you if you did like the upvoting and downvoting model that like, I think like Reddit and like some of the like Mentimeter and things like they use these where you get to like, everybody can submit a question, but you can get to upvote it or downvote it on like how relevant it is. I think that kind of crowdsourcing can absolutely bring about, you know, some more truthful type of like, okay, this is really the wisdom in the crowd.
Wisdom of the crowds, as I think it was Pentland talks about, it's wisdom of the crowd works as long as people can't see each other's responses. So like once you have a social dynamic there, mm-hmm. people can see each other's responses, then it changes the dynamics. But anyway.
Yeah, because social desirability comes
exactly, or you get influenced. You get influenced by citation count, which we talked a few weeks ago about.
Well, do you want me to maybe? No, do you have one more?
I got one more. This is kind of interesting. So it's from our boy Ethan Mollick.
Tried and true.
ChatGPT generated more, cheaper, and better ideas than folks in an innovation class. More important than the vast majority of the best ideas, the pooled sample are generated by ChatGPT and not by the students. So ChatGPT is generating more, cheaper, and better ideas.
Yep. No need for humans.
Damn it.
I'm running out of steam here, man, because like I had two more articles to talk about. I'm like, man, we talked about these a bunch. And then I'm hearing the topic about like ChatGPT generating good ideas. I'm like, man, that's depressing.
Do you not want to talk about it?
No, it's like I just, again, sometimes I get really excited about these things. And other times I think about what do people like to do? Well, generally, like, you know, if you're an intellectual field, you like generating ideas. And then it's like, well, now there's a machine that's better than all human beings at generating ideas than you, right? It's like, okay, well, now that's something else I got to live with.
Well, like, I think it kind of coincides with the crowdsourcing we just talked about. Like, just because, like, if you ever, and I'm sure it's going to get better, but like try to get DALL-E or something like that to generate an image for you, it'll throw together just random shit. And the random shit together is pretty cool. But I've also seen some avant-garde artists like put like cat shit on like a ceiling fan and like put it in a museum and watch it fly around, you know? Not literally, but probably.
No, probably literally.
Probably literally. And it's like, just because you like put together diverse things and make something unique or creative doesn't necessarily mean that it's good or has impact.
Yeah. I guess I come down kind of on the artistic side of things here where I like, it's hard to define what is art, right? Music, you know, like painting, like what, and so to me, almost like my personal definition of art is like something that inspires you. Right. Something that causes emotion that maybe you wouldn't have felt without the stimuli. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And none of this stuff stirs any emotion in me. You know, it's just like, okay.
Oh man, Nihilist Cole. Here we go.
What?
Nihilist Cole.
It's not. No, I'm talking about the machine generated stuff.
You can definitely see like writing that you're like, this just doesn't feel human.
Exactly. It doesn't stir. It doesn't motivate me. It doesn't inspire me. It's just like it informs me,
which
is fine. That serves a valid purpose. I'm not like, I'm just saying like when I think about this from like an art perspective, like I was listening to a new song this morning that I found, and like I started listening to it on repeat. I was like, man, it's like something inside me like changed because I listened to this song for the first time, and I was like, this is a fantastic song. And I feel like the listening to it over and over again is trying to discover like what is that thing, what is that spark that just went off. And like, to me, that's like the beauty of humanity. And I just don't want to lose that. Like, I feel like that's too precious to lose. And I don't know. I guess I don't know what I'm
saying. Not to mention, like, I was told that all the shitty tasks were going to be automated and I was going to be painting.
Yeah.
No.
Then it's like the opposite. It's like, you've got to do all the shitty tasks and so we can paint for you.
So, like, what am I supposed to do now? Like, have, like, even inferior paintings that I...
And if, not, like, and then the paintings won't inspire you too.
So like now, like, have you heard like all this research that like specifically like teenage girls that they go on Instagram, you know, whatever social media of your choice, they put filters on their photos and then they feel inferior or like they feel upset because they can't live up to like the standard.
Yeah, they feel inferior to themselves.
To themselves or even, you know, influencers as it were. Kind of the same thing. It's like I could go out and like paint something terrible and like this sort of thing, but you look at whatever Gen AI creates, is like, damn, that looks pretty sick. Honestly, it looks pretty awesome.
Well, have you ever told a lie that made you look really like good or important? Right. Well, guess what? It actually eats at you because you know it's not the truth.
Yeah.
It's kind of the same thing. It's like, well, like, I wish I was more beautiful. So I put a filter on, it made me more beautiful. And then I realized that that was a lie. And that makes me feel inferior. And mm-hmm. It's like, it's a negative feedback loop.
Oh, you want to do one more and get out of here?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. This is kind of speaking of like the stuff that eats at you to be a happier, more successful person. Get off the hedonic treadmill. So research has shown that many high performers are affected by micro stresses, an ongoing accumulation of small pressures. I'm going to mess up this word. Eudaimonic pursuits. I don't know. I messed that up. Pursuits are outwardly focused, whereas hedonic activities are concerned with self-centered fulfillment. Those who manage micro stresses successfully also tend to create sense of purpose by giving back to others. So essentially, the more you want stuff, the more material stuff you want. So it becomes like a pattern.
I feel like this is like the basis of Buddhism.
Kind of.
Like they're like rediscovering it scientifically, but it's like, yeah, material possessions is what gonna rule you, and you know, don't do that.
here's some like basic quotes we can gnaw on if we choose to. Getting more material stuff makes you want more material stuff, what researchers call hedonic treadmill.
Mm-hmm. Can I talk about the hedonic treadmill for a second?
I think you should.
So considering they're our sponsor, I think it's okay for me to say this. So like I got invited to the Lightcast conference last fall, and I was supposed to give this presentation on AI and people analytics. And it was one of the last presentations of the conference, and like literally every presentation before me was about AI and its impact on people analytics or some other topic. And I was like,
feeling I know where this is going, but
I can't talk about this. Everybody has talked about it. And so what I did is I got up there and I just put it on my intro slide. And then I had written a few notes about the hedonic treadmill of AI and its relationship to what we're all going through right now. And just winged a whole like 20 or 30 minute presentation based on some notes that I have. And it's so funny how the arguably one of the most miraculous inventions in the history of humanity is already like, we're already going, I wonder what's next.
Meh.
Yeah.
Meh. Show me something better.
Right? It's like, well, we just invented the printing press. Well, we can't wait till they invent the internet, you know, like, and so it is funny that we're already to that point, and I'm as guilty of it just as much as the next person of like, okay, well, what's it going to do next? Because I'm already bored by it.
You want to hear totally changing topics? You want to hear something crazy about Gutenberg and the printing press I learned the other day?
What is it?
So, of course, he like essentially like repurposed a wine press and made these like little lead letters, you know, obviously you can print with.
Mm-hmm.
But that really wasn't the invention that made it possible. He had to like reformulate ink to actually stick. So he went through a whole process of trying to like make it stickier and like had to like... because the ink that they were using kind of like bled through the paper, but he needed something that would stick. And which is like the surface of the paper.
What did he put in it that made it sticky?
I don't know, man. Probably cat's gut or so. I don't know what the hell he did.
Like tree sap.
Tree sap and like forage for salt wort or something like that.
Yeah. You probably put super glue in it. Have you ever tried to get super glue off? It's like impossible.
You probably went down to Mont Blanc and said, hey, let's do some of this. Are we done?
I think we're done. All right, dude. Well, hey, man, it's super cool seeing you in person. Doing this is a lot of fun. But you've been listening to Directionally Correct, a People Analytics podcast with Cole and Scott, and today's guest, Nobody.
Bye.
Hey, guys. Directionally Correct is dedicated to you, our listeners, to help educate and entertain you on how to effectively do people analytics. By supporting this podcast, you are helping us continue to provide valuable insights and knowledge to our listeners. Please consider becoming a patron of the podcast. You can find the link to sign up in the show notes or at patron.podbean.com/directionallycorrect. Thanks for your support.